Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Well, hi, everyone. I'm super excited to be here. I'm here with Jason Watkins, who's a colonel in the United States Air Force, and we crossed paths a couple of years ago and just pretty much hit it off right away because Jason's focus is really on teams and leadership development and building high cohesion, high performing teams. So every time I talk with you, Jason, we just have so much to talk about and I just have so much to learn from you. You know, what is really fun is that like I really look at teams and sort of the psychology of teams and work mostly with civilians, right? But like you are really have this whole other lens working with people in the military. And it's really fun to just kind of see where the parallels are, where the areas of difference are, and just have great conversations. So I won't even try to take a stab at your decorated experience, but I would love for you to share just a bit about who you are and what you've done in the military and who you are as a person.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Dr. Wegner. I appreciate the invite. I'm definitely excited to be here with you today. And yeah, I agree. It's great to kind of share those parallels and see what is going on in academia and industry versus what the military is doing. We often look to industry and academia to build our own teaching models. And so I just really appreciate our partnership and working together and finding new ways to navigate, you know, how to strengthen teams. So I think, thanks again. But to answer your question, I enlisted in the Air Force. I've been in almost 30 years. In 1995, just drawn to the idea of being around the airplanes. My dad was a naval helicopter pilot and enlisted in the Air Force, just trying to figure out a way to pay for school. And of course, GI Bill. So I did the enlistment for the first 4 or 5 years, met my wife along the way, and ended up doing a program where I was able to finish school, graduated with an aviation management degree from Embry-Riddle, and then got a commission. From there, I picked up flying. I went to the route of the F-15E. It's a two-seat multi-role aircraft. And I spent about 20 years flying in that capacity, eventually worked my way as an instructor, teaching people to fly that airframe. And along the way, I got to cross over to leadership development in the Air Force, where I focused on really human domain type things. So communication, connection, crisis management, crisis leadership, emotional intelligence, and then some of the deeper things that, you know, one thing that I think maybe separates the military is the fact that our leaders are constantly making decisions that affect life or death at this level. So they're very serious and often, you know, just like a healthcare worker would, we go through our own set of trauma. So this idea of prevention, intervention, and postvention training, suicide awareness and response to that. We focus on that. So yeah, that's I did that for several years. That's where our paths crossed. And now I am leading an organization that's an experimental organization that basically trains the way the Air Force is now coming together purposefully as a team to prepare forces for the combatant commander and the American public and articulate how the Air Force employs us as a unit into combat environments. So I know that's a lot, but that's where I'm at right now. And I've gotten kind of a unique insight lately to see and build my own team and train purposely together. And we're about midway through that cycle right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just A, wildly impressive. And secondly, I just so appreciate your service and your thoughtfulness and your commitment. It's just, you've been doing this for so long, and clearly I just know that you've been on, you know, multiple deployments and are all over the globe doing these different things, and you still really have your eye on like the human, right? It's like, you know, it's like you're really focused on how to help people kind of feel and function their best, I think, within your teams and in your organization. And what does this look like also from a leadership perspective? But you know, I'd love to start with just when you think about really like a high performing team, what even comes mind to you? Like, what are what variable? Like, how do you even define that? What does that look like for you?
Gosh, that's such a great question. But I think one of the things that I'm passionate about is like with sport and teaming in general. And I think about like a soccer team that's very dynamic. It does, you have kind of a set of script plays, but there's nothing finite. Like maybe in American football, there's, you run a play, the person does this position. So there's an element to that. But in a soccer team, folks are reacting to uncertainty. And you just kind of have to know where your teammate is going to be through lots of interconnectedness and exposure to each other. That you just, it's almost like this sixth sense that you can zen where that person's going to be when you pass them the ball, that kind of thing. So I translate that into my work environment where how do I get folks connected together? That's the very first step so that we're in that level of dynamic environment. They have at least a kind of a left right limit idea of where they're going to be at in a certain situation. So that's my very first step getting into when I build a team, bringing folks from all sorts of different walks of life. How do I get those individuals on a personal level communicating and taking a step further and learning about that other person in front of them? I think that's the first thing,
Yeah,
foundationally.
I mean, it's like, yeah, I would love to just like, how do you even train for that? Because like what you're describing feels so like visceral, right? It's sort of like this, and we were kind of chatting before we started recording. We were talking about these different leadership qualities, one of them being like intuition, really, and like a lot of that feels like intuitive, seeing around the corner before, things happen, but also this connection with each other. How do you like train for that, or how can you operationalize that at all?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I think that that the Louis Pasteur quote, "Fortune favors the prepared mind." I don't necessarily believe in luck. I know we talk about luck is maybe this idea of opportunity and timing come together, but you just got to get people together. And for my organization, where I'm at right now, I really got to see, it's been fascinating where we did very benign, safe setting. Where we didn't have a lot of tasks in the beginning, and we just really focused on getting to know each other in a variety of ways, whether that be just fun activities, going out and just doing physical fitness together, or some very basic building block things for our actual workspace. But I think where you really test that is when you start to crank up the rheostat, and you almost have to set the structure for that at a certain point. I don't know when that point is, but you have to start with an idea of I've got to get folks connected. I've got to get them having a basic level understanding. And then I got to maybe intensify the situation just a little bit. And so we create scenarios where we either create time constraints or threat-based constraints and allow that friction to come out and then help people navigate that friction. That's really where we learn about each other, and then we have to take the time to step back and see how we behaved in those situations and the decisions that we made. Those two things are our behaviors and how we perceive the environment, and then finally, how did we act on those perceptions.
I know it's like really just incredible to just like listen to you sort of tell the story of how you do this. And I feel, I work with a bunch of organizations, and I feel like sometimes the military gets sort of like cited as being this like very, hard and almost unemotional, unrelational kind of organization. But what I know from it is pretty much like what you've described, which like building the relationship is mission critical. Like you have to have that level of connectedness to be able to operate at a high level, because that connection cohesion is what drives the performance. So, and of course there's like expectations and there is this sort of like toughness that comes along with that. But it sounds like what you tell me that it's rooted in building like a real sort of connection at the front end on a human front that then sort of evolves into more of an operational or performance like thing.
I would agree with that. I think, if your objective is how do I, but maybe the question, the driving question is how do I build a high performing team? If that's what we're trying to do here. And one, you got to define what that means to you. I see a high performing team as folks that understand a challenge and that are able to surface a level of friction, healthy amount of friction without tearing each other down, and then understand their strengths and weaknesses, and then accomplish the objective together, whatever that objective is. That's kind of, I don't know if there's a really, I'm sure there are plenty of definitions out there, but that's how I, that's my driving question. And that, that has been for this endeavor. It's been great to think through it in that lens. But then you got to kind of dial back, like, how do we get there? And like I said, the very first thing for me in every environment is to get people connected. Mm-hmm. And so I've done this approach where we started at the personal level. Let's learn about each other. And then we're focused very much on small team. I call it small team enrichment. Mm-hmm. And that is, you can't just go from this. There's an element of, for me as leading a large organization, where I put out some basic kind of cultural rules of engagement, but then I need to get those small teams working together before we can go to the next level. So it's kind of, you do start from the bottom, individually connected, and then small teams connected, where I can, where those small groups work to each other with. And then you got to watch out for the silos starting to develop as well. Mm-hmm. So then how do I combine two teams or two or to three teams to accomplish something? So the, you get into, like, I don't know if you read Stanley McChrystal's Team of Teams book, looking for gaps and seams. And so that gaps and seams to me is a communications challenge. Mm-hmm. And so now we're, you know, the next step after I've got folks connected and I've got those teams built is I look for ways to increase communication. And that is a constant challenge, keeping the themes, developing the themes, keeping them simple and transmittable, and looking for ways to transmit those that sometimes, especially for me, you know, I've been in the service for 30 years, cross-generational as well. That's a constant challenge, and I have to bring in folks from different perspectives and help me help ground me in different ways that I need to think about my communication strategy. So I'd start with connection and then build off that small team enrichment, and then look for how we're communicating, really observe how we're communicating, and then build my themes, my marketing strategy, if you will, to help the communication get transmitted between those teams of teams.
Yeah, no, it's like we're chatting at the beginning that sort of like psychology is everywhere, right? It's just like you, it's like that's just part of who we are. And then you kind of contextualize it to different environments. But I think the parallels with, like, you know, if there's people who are in, you know, private organizations or more corporations, like the parallels are the same. It's like you're talking about bringing people together, building relationship, and then effectively like scaling out, really starting with small teams and then kind of like folding more people. And so we work with a lot of hyper growth companies that are bringing people in at a rapid pace, but how do you like keep the cohesion as that's happening? You know, and then you're really talking about looking for those like gaps and seams to be like, where is that friction? How can I address it? And then you're really, sounds like you're really looking at the role of communication to bridge some of those gaps, you know. And we, you know, I always say, we kind of, we'll say that connection or communication is the kind of currency of cohesion or connection. So like us talking to each other is how we're going to bridge those gaps. And then, you know, you might like to be communicated with in one way. I like to might be communicated in a different way. So knowing that about each other. But also, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. It's not about right or wrong or better or worse. It's like, what are we here to do? What are the goals, the shared goals that we've set out? And what's like the best communication or the best approach? I think you call it like, you call it rules of engagement, like in sort of psychobabble words. Like we talk about like group norms or, you know, work norms or, you know, in and then like companies, I think it's really kind of like their value systems, the how to, like, what are we going to all collectively subscribe by to get these things done?
Yeah. So it's interesting you brought that up. Actually, it takes me back to when we started this team that I'm in right now. We did kind of a professional development or cultural team building event where everybody defined and codified with those rules of engagement, but basically what our norms, behaviors as a team, and we agreed on that. We kind of slapped the table and said, this is how we're going to be as a team, and how are we going to hold each other accountable to those particular sets of rules that we came up with. You know, if somebody has another idea and someone interrupts, how do we treat that behavior as a team? You know, how do we surface some of the quieter voices in the room? Mm-hmm. How do we surface dissent? That's an exercise we did early on that takes me back. That was definitely a kind of also foundational and to provide a way to increase connectedness between us.
Yeah, it's kind of making the implicit explicit, which then is easier to operate on. If you can just be like, all right, let's just talk about it and put it on the table, and then you're setting up the social contract, right? So with a lot of the companies we work with that are in like sort of these hyper growth stages, like their mission, vision, values, like are there, they exist, but they're not actually really tended to often, not always, but mm-hmm. often. So we're like, let's get in here and like really let's do this and make sure everybody, the loud people and the quieter people, like have a voice in co-creating this thing, and then set the norms around how do we want to give each other feedback? What are we going to do when things get tough? Like, and you were talking about, but this is like, you know, group, what we focus on in group psychology is like making sure everybody who are the quieter folks in the space and getting them to share, but also that friction and conflict is a signal in a high performing team, right? And being able to navigate, negotiate that and do it like, hopefully at like, you know, a relative, you know, as whatever pace, the better, the higher trust and higher psychological safety, the faster you can move through those moments of conflict. And a lot of teams we see like are scared of that. They don't want to do it. We know about, you know, people do not like giving feedback or conflict, generally speaking, in a lot of organizations. So getting people in the habit and understanding that like this is actually really important.
Yeah. So, gosh, you sparked a few ideas I want to contribute to this conversation and kind of overstep this idea of trust as well. Mm-hmm. And building that connection. You know, I think when we talk about what is a high trust team, which is to me is a component of a high performing team, it's a foundational component. But if you don't get to a place where you experience friction and figure out ways to navigate that friction, I think that trust starts to decay a little bit. And so there is a element to purposefully building these teams to that we do try to create scenarios in our training environments that increase the stress, whether that be a time-based deliverable that the team has to come up with and generate, you know, through military tasks and evaluate risk and that kind of thing together as a team and problem solve together and give them a time-based constraint or a threat-based constraint with life or death decisions sometimes on the line. And you start to see that friction come out, and then it's how you navigate that friction. And what you see is folks from different perspectives with different, maybe some cultural values start to clash. Mm-hmm. And what comes out of that, I think is very important. Sometimes you get folks that are, you know, offended. Maybe someone didn't turn this thing in on time or somebody elevated their voice and shouted or, you know, swore or something, right? Military mm-hmm. that happens. It's what you do on the back end, both as a leader and as a teammate, when that something that behavior or decision results in something that could decay trust. Mm-hmm. We always talk about it, it's like, hey, once trust has been broke, it's been broke. But I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory. Mm-hmm. I think what's more important is that you realize that there was a tension between you and that other person or other team, that you surface that and that you look for ways to repair it. And then your trust just gets just that much more thicker and deeper. Mm-hmm. That's where real growth occurs in the team. I think you've got to experience that, see where the differences lie, acknowledge those differences, and then figure out how you're going to grow and come together after that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We always, you know, the language we use, I guess, is rupture and repair. And so we have this idea, I think, generally speaking, that like, you know, trust is like a linear, right? Like the more we're together and more trust, but rather seeing like there's periods of closeness and there's periods of distance, there's periods of rupture and there's periods of repair. So like, you're going to do something that's going to bother me at some point, at some level, right? Whether it's minor or major, but there's something that's going to rupture a little bit our relationship. It could be something small, like I said something wrong, or I might really hurt you in some way, right? And oftentimes when those happen, we sort of break the relationship and then we just move on. But the repair is like where the depth comes. It's like when you can actually move towards that conflict or that friction and then take it deeper. It actually helps strengthen the relationship. That's where connection cohesion lives. And so how can we help our people sort of normalize that pattern of rupture and repair, look for it, and then train them to actually move towards it in a way that's like, also, this is where skills come in. Like, people need help knowing how to do this to actually deepen the connection, the cohesion.
So that was a question I was going to toss back in your lane there is how what sort of skills would you recommend? Because that's to me that's a really hard area to focus in. Like what do you teach your students and your teams there on that rupture
Yeah.
aspect?
This is where, like, this is what I like about psychology. There's different disciplines within it, right? So you can like look for different domains and pull from it. Couples therapy does this right? It does a lot right in this area. The Gottman Institute is all focused on couples and conflict and signals, like all the stuff. And so, like, when I was doing more like therapy work, like seeing people in practice, those skills translate to organizations. So, like, what I've done with couples, pretty much I've done this with a founding, a founder, and a new CEO. I've done these in different constructs where I get people to talk, but the skills are the same. So the hurt person, right, the person who's been like offended or hurt, generally will say like, I'm hurt. And the person who's hurt them will start to explain the behavior like, well, I didn't mean to hurt you, or like, I didn't. And now you're like engaging in this rational thing, which now the hurt person's like in the position of like convincing the person why their feelings are hurt, which just creates more distance. So the first step is really getting the person who sort of did the offending to just listen and reflect back. So it's like almost opening an emotional gasket. It's like, okay, like, I've noticed that like I hurt you in whatever capacity, or I've ruptured whatever we had in some way, and I want to make it better. Help me understand. And then this is, we use a framework for motivational interviewing where it's like asking open-ended questions, like what and how questions, just making short reflective statements back. Like, it sounds like when I, didn't show up on time, it really hurt you. You saw it as a sign of disrespect, something like that. And then the person just keeps sharing, but through that experience of just sharing, they're increasing, like feeling sort of a sense of belonging that you're really listening and that like you're really in it. And like that sort of, you just feel the emotional heat like go down in the room, And then once they've sort of like shared, then you can sort of check in with the person. It sounds like this really, I'll do my best not to do that again. And, onward we go. So there is like a bit of a pattern that happens that kind of needs to happen. But most of it's like the,
Notice the behavior, share, and I think what I heard come out of what you just said there is this idea of intentionality, right? That
exactly.
acknowledging that you didn't enter the conversation or the communication misfire with the idea that you're trying to hurt somebody or that other person.
Yeah.
And I think oftentimes folks, call it maybe fundamental attribution error, a psychological term, but you can pose this idea onto somebody else, what you think they're doing. That's not the case at all, right?
Oh,
Once
yeah.
you've kind of leveled the bubble there and surfaced those ideas that, hey, we're both trying to do our best at whatever the thing is. There was no intention of trying to hurt you. You can start the conversation. But what I often see from my perch in leading a large organization is sometimes, especially at the low echelons where the silos have started to develop, is this perception that there's this level of competition and that maybe one side is trying to undercut the other side to get the thing or whatever. And I don't think that's the case in most situations, is it kind of what you just said there.
Oh yeah. This is like Carl, so like in sort of coaching, but it's like whether it's coaching or whether it's like teaching leaders to kind of coach, or whether it's training a psychologist, it's Carl Rogers does this, right? Sort of like humanistic psychology. It's unconditional positive regard. It's like, I might not agree with the behavior, but I will like foundationally sort of like love you as a human. There's nothing you could do that would make me sort of like care less for you as a human being. But there's, it doesn't mean I agree with your behaviors or there's not room to grow. But like there's this sort of like non-judgmental stance. which I think, I'm interested because as a military person, I think there's this idea sometimes, people think of psychology as super, soft and emotional, and it is, but it actually, by naming these things and understanding it, it gives you variables and levers to push on. You're operationalizing the dynamics in the room, which then allow you to solve problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Versus just like, it's not just all, hugging each other and, emotional expressions.
So that has direct applicability. It's something I think I love that idea. Unconditional positive regard by Rogers. Yeah. I think we talked about that a couple of years ago in some of our coaching things. But that idea, we, as for commanders and leaders, senior leaders in the military, what's interesting, I think that does kind of separate us from industry and perhaps academia, is this idea that we have a level of authority that is punitive. Normally, you wouldn't have a CEO that could, certainly could fire you, but put someone towards a, court martial or imprison them. And so, military through U.S. law has that authority to do that. So that's a key difference. And what I'm getting at here is sometimes there are folks in the unit that where a commander would impose that level of authority, and would have to step back and try and look at his objective at this at the behavior that happened to make a decision. And I think that embracing that mindset of an unconditional positive regard is very helpful, right? Look at the look at the behavior. Don't pin it on the person, and do your best to then evaluate objectively for that. But it also applies to coaching in general. It applies to I think feedback or feed forward, however you'd like to bend that, and helping somebody maybe through whatever conflict that they're going through at that time. So, love
Yeah,
it.
it's like preserving the relationship because I think when you have that mentality, you can preserve the relationship in a way and then sort of externalize the behavior a bit and then like solve it together. But sometimes I think I see this in organizations, leaders feel like they have to like be the tough guy or the bad guy or teach in a way that's very top down. And junior people will nod and they'll listen and they'll be like, I'll do whatever I have to do because I want to keep this job. But like, they're not actually really truly learning or really understanding. And it ruptures the relationship, which then can rupture the connection or cohesion on the team, which ultimately affects the organization. So, the way then that shows up is in sort of retention, engagement, satisfaction, like all the things that cost companies money, right? It's, probably different for you all, but similar kind of when you want to preserve the relationship because all outcomes, whether they're performance or well-being or, retention, come from highly cohesive, highly connected, really, because we're hardwired for connection, social by nature.
So what's interesting you say that too is, I think the military does in some areas do a pretty good job on helping develop leaders in that
Oh,
human
yeah.
domain area, but we also have a bit of a knowledge and training gap too. We focus very heavily on the STEM, the hard sciences, and to our own detriment sometimes. And I think sometimes leaders will step into the role favoring that, a cost business approach of something, or looking more of the strategic management side of the house, and those ruptures happen at lower echelons, and then they left untreated become toxic throughout the organization. You do have to really kind of put some focus and emphasis on getting folks back together. That, to me, it's one thing to create the team, but once you got folks together in a room and going after things, what do you do when things go sideways? That's where we start to move up the continuum of developing towards a high power team, high performance team, where we're able to acknowledge those, fissures, and figure out ways to grow together. And that starts again, like you said, with communication, with having maybe some deeper heart to hearts, deeper conversation, making sure that we have acknowledged the other person as a human being, trying to do the best,
Yeah, that was the word that came to mind as I was listening to you, is about acknowledgement. And I think really great leaders are good when you're talking about almost like seeing ahead or the intuitive is almost, and we teach psychologists this, like in every team meeting or whatever you're leading, you want to sort of mentally be assessing how cohesive is this group or team. And then you do different things depending on where that number is. What I think you're saying is that like good leaders are really good at noticing those sort of like connection, cohesion in real time, seeing when there's a bit of a fissure or a rupture about to or happening or live, and then noticing it, naming it, acknowledging it, moving towards it, and then like moving through it.
Yeah, so I see, and I'm not throwing shade at any of my colleagues, but sometimes folks will try to distance themselves when they're further up the food chain. And sometimes for good reasons or bad reasons, but what happens is when you become aloof and disconnected, you miss that sensing mechanism. You almost step to the next point, like you think that that the team is doing okay. And it's one of those situations where, ignorance is bliss, I guess. But you really got to try and figure out what your listening and sensing ecosystem looks like and constantly assess that as well. And that takes you back to the connectedness piece. So kind of almost a continuous reset to how are we connected?
Well, when we're training psychologists, we like it's like I always use this metaphor. I'm like, you have to take yourself out of the role almost. It's almost like weird. It's like I'm like, you are the tool. So if you have a feeling of anxiety and you feel anxious, it's you don't think I'm anxious. You think there's anxiety there, and then you're thinking almost like you're an empty vessel. You're noticing anxiety and you're curious, is it you? Is it the other person, or is there the environment or the dynamic in between? So now you're kind of like operationalizing this feeling. And now you're making that implicit thing explicit, and then you're bringing it up to the like the patient or whoever you're working with, right? It's like, and then you're kind of talking with them, like, so it's that sort of idea of counter transference, right? You're like using this feeling thing, putting it on the table, and then and kind of dissecting it. But as a psychologist, like, I'm really help people try to like almost separate themselves from the feelings, and then notice the feelings, and then bring them up in a way. To
It's
like,
sort of this idea like metacognition, right?
yeah,
Stepping outside,
exactly.
thinking about your thinking, to stepping out purposely, reflecting, like, how did I behave at that moment? And if you're just going on from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, are you ever taking those deliberate periods to reflect on how you behaved and how you perceive the environment? And then finally, how did you act on those
Oh,
perceptions?
yeah. Yeah, it's like you are a tool. Right? Your body's a tool, and we can actually start to pay attention to it in a deeper way. There's a whole bunch of information there that you have to, that like you can get curious about and then use it to understand whatever the dynamic is that you're like existing in. I know we're kind of coming to the end of time, and I could just keep talking with you about this forever. But I mean, one thing you didn't
Likewise.
mention when you were, rattling off your sort of all your accomplishments was that you're also getting your doctorate in leadership right now. Is that right?
An education from Drexel.
Oh, education. Okay, education. And that you're really exploring this idea of cognitive agility,
That's
right?
right. Yep.
And so, yeah, I know this would be a whole other that podcast. Would love to have you on to talk more, or have you class to talk about this. But what comes to mind for you when you think about that?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. So the idea for cognitive agility, whether you call it mental agility or flexibility, is to be confronted in these sort of increasingly complex environments that we are, providing kind of an adaptive leadership shift, but doing that, and how do I help develop senior leaders as a military educator, as an educator in general, navigate these uncertainty environments and not maybe, like you talked about, this sort of meta way, step out, think about their thinking, and be able to shift their frame to see a different perspective and predict better, make better decisions, and so on. And part of that, I think, from my perspective, is we've really got to enrich those human domain skills to be able to help with that agility. So things like emotional intelligence, communication, connection, how to behave and act in crisis, and then creativity, I think, is a sort of at least in the military, a training gap that we have. And through those types of training environments, which are hard to define, and they're hard to quantify, but you help leaders become a little bit more calm under pressure and accept a wide range of perspectives and be able to navigate those. We call them the military word VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous environments. So navigating uncertainty with a little bit more groundedness and ability to shift your frame.
Yeah, no, I know that just, it's like the translation, I think, to sort of the public sector is like really sort of like creativity and innovation, you know, and like knowing that highly cohesive teams where there's high levels of psychological safety, people are way more likely to be more creative and innovative and take risk in that way, kind of play with those concepts and then be able to like adapt to different environments more flexibly, right? It's because they're sort of like are broadening the way your scope, basically.
And that's critical for, I think, for our senior military leaders. Like I said, we are, you know, with the interconnectedness of the world and lots of different variables, both domestically and internationally, how do you navigate these increasingly complex environments, making life or death decisions, and enhance our own capacity for prediction, right? Anticipatory thinking and be able to shift and watch for those mental mind traps occurring. Kind of like you said, step out and see those on yourself there. That's the area that I've been playing with a little bit. You could certainly use your help.
Super cool. I want to talk to you about it. Well, it's making me think of like looking at your own patterns, because we all have patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving. So like when you can actually understand what your own patterns are and how they're showing up in different environments, right? Then at least you can, I guess, in, so to speak, like see around, like you know how you tend to behave. And if you can see that, and then, I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud, but like, yes, happy to talk about all of this. It's super, super exciting and really fun. But just as we're getting ready to end, is there anything I didn't ask you about that you would want to, you know, either share about yourself or your amazing work or anything really?
No, I do think kind of starting where we're beginning, it's really awesome to be able to bring in folks from all walks of life across the country and in my line of work, and then put them in sort of the pressure cooker situation and watch those team dynamics. And I'm learning a lot from it. We'll see where this goes, but it's just, yeah, I think that what I'm learning right now is you do have to kind of get to that friction in a healthy way. That's the next step. I don't know what's next, but right there and then helping people stay connected like constantly. That's something that I'm focused on right now. So.
Well, if you ever need some, you know, girl from Boston to fly out and observe with you and think alongside
by all means,
I'll be on the next flight. That sounds so fun. Well, you know, I just so appreciate taking time, Jason, spending time, and it feels weird to not call you by your title, but I'm sensitive because knowing that, you know, this is also everything you're sharing is really your thoughts and feelings and not representative of the Air Force. So I just want to be conscious of that and put that out there. But I just appreciate you taking time and just sharing all your wisdom and your experience and just all the service you've given to our country for such a long time.
Well, I appreciate it. And I appreciate what you do in academia. And, you know, I learned just as much from you as I'm sure you from me about the military side of the house. But I look forward to continuing this partnership, and thank you.
Amazing.